On the one hand, what?
It's hard to find it.
The need and the value of this study on the one hand against what my dad used to call wear and tear on the machinery, meaning emotional wear and tear on all the folks out in my district and Representative Baum's district and Representative Dwyer's district and all these other places that are hearing that they're going to be fingerprinted when they went by a shotgun. It's got to be a pretty important study. And, I mean, I guess that's what you're telling me we're balancing here, is the need for this study to get some good information so that hopefully down the road, and I'm not seeing the balance right now.
Recently, there was a study done by the U.S. Department of Justice, known by the names of the people who did it, Wright and Rossi from Harvard, I believe they were, and they surveyed incarcerated felons in 10 states and federal penitentiaries, and they came up with a figure that 6% of the felons purchased their handgun or their firearms through dealer channels, and that the majority of those use surrogate buyers, wives, girlfriends, other associates who did not have criminal records. I think I have a copy of the Wright-Rossi study. I'll be happy to furnish it if the committee would like to see it.
I'd like to see it.
Annex has something, but I want to get real quick. How much is it going to cost for this inside of this study for every one of these fingerprints to be run? What's $12 a piece? For right kind of fingerprint?
Major Renfro from the state police did have a figure, and that was brought forward, but I do not recall what it was. It has to do with equipment they're attempting to put into the Identification Bureau anyway.
Amount for fingerprint multiplied times the number of guns bought in Oregon in order to run this study. Fingerprint in the study right now. Do you have anything to add to that? Briefly add to that issue?
The question was the cost that would.
Chairman Calhoun, Major Renfro again. We did a research project based on 20,000 increments, in other words, 20,000 individuals processed in increments up to 100,000. We estimated that for each individual, it would require, based upon this automated system, about $10 a piece for a transaction. If it was 100,000 that we did over a two-year period, for example, it would be close to $1 million, just under $1 million.
Mr. Nichols, I want to take you back to your comments about the Virginia driver's permit. I take it that they have tougher cross checks in Virginia, and they maybe are a little better about taking away permits from people who shouldn't have them.
Yes, Representative Mannix. If I might, I would refer to where'd he go? Dave Marshall, the legislative liaison for the National Rifle Association, is a former resident of Virginia who is quite familiar with their system. And
I think it's worth a momentary detour, Mr. Chairman, since we are talking about identification. And could I hear about the Virginia system for a moment, please?
Call yourself for the record and tell us what you have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave Marshall with the National Rifle Association, liaison for the Western United States. The question regarding the Virginia, is it the driver's license you're referring to?
Yes.
The Virginia driver's license is assigned by the Social Security number of the individual. For instance, every citizen knows his Social Security number. If you would take that Social Security number and put the initials VA in front of it, you now have your Virginia driver's license. It's readily identifiable. It's unique to the individual. And any citizen in the United States who happens to travel and take up residency in Virginia would have his own number. He'd well know it in advance. They have a high-quality control of that. They are up to date. Their DMV, the Department of Motor Vehicles, is computerized. Information is available regarding the background of the individual. When I say the background, the information on the driver's license is available, and generally a very it's similar to date of birth, place of residency, height, weight, all of those criteria that we find on many driver's licenses around the United States. The major difference is that they have a Social Security number as their ID number.
Mr. Chairman, may I follow up on that?
Please.
I don't want to move us too far off the track in terms of this bill because of all the agreements that have been built into it, but I'm still curious why we've sort of dropped what I'll call a proactive rather than reactive option. By that I mean the option of just saying, look, let's have a system in Oregon where you can positively identify through your own piece of government-issued identification citizens who do not have a criminal record, do not have a mental history. And if that person can walk in and we could have voluntary compliance too, even at gun shows, but in terms of dealers, if you have this card, it just and it's current, it shows that you don't have a criminal history and you don't have a mental history. If it was a tightly issued card in terms of availability, has that option been considered by the group, and would it work? That is, people are worried about being classified as criminals, and of course my point constantly is I just want to make sure that the guy I sell a gun to isn't some sort of nut or some sort of felon, and I don't care whether it's a dealer selling the gun or it's a private citizen. I'd be happy to say, hey, look, it's as easy as getting as a driver's license if you're clean. Do you have your Oregon citizen's ID card or whatever you want to call it? What's your reaction to that?
Well, I wasn't involved in the initial discussions or the preliminary negotiations involving this particular bill. But I will point out that this problem is not unique to Oregon. In fact, there is a general desire on the part of law-abiding gun owners around the country and law enforcement. Yes, we do concur to try and keep firearms out of the hands of the wrong people without necessarily or adversely impacting law-abiding gun owners. For the first time, as part of President, and we took a major step in that direction just recently in Washington, D.C. As part of President Reagan's omnibus drug program last year, the Congress initially considered a waiting period, a 7-day waiting period, referred to as the Brady Amendment. The Brady Amendment was, the waiting period was not accepted by the Congress. Instead, they opted for a centralized registration, if you would, of felons throughout the country, a computerized centralization of these people. It made much more sense to Congress to compile and to put on a computer list the list of prescribed individuals, namely the bad guys, rather than the good guys. It made more sense to Congress to do a quick reference against a known group of individuals rather than conduct background checks on 200 million Americans. As such, the NRA strongly supported that approach. That has been adopted by Virginia, for instance, as it relates to handguns. It is now being worked upon by the U.S. Department of Justice. They're due out by the end of the year. The idea is somewhat like there will be, and if I can just digress for a minute, there'll be like and this is not set in concrete, but they certainly seem to be heading in this direction. There will be some type of computer terminal available to gun dealers and law enforcement around the country. A quick reference will be like a credit card. You know, when you go to purchase a credit card purchase, you submit your credit card and you get a green light or a red light. Either you're good for it or you're not good for it. They don't conduct a credit reference or a credit check into your background. That is the ultimate program that they're looking to pursue, and it's one that we strongly support. Virginia has adopted that and has gone into effect, I believe, January of this past year. The feds are working on it as far as a matter of national policy. We understand that there will be a biological determinant in that. There will be some biological IDing. In other words, you've got to assure yourselves that the person before you is the person they say they are. That seems to be the problem. And it's a problem, obviously, here in Oregon as well as other states and in Washington. So we have, to put it, if I can capsulize it, they're moving in the direction of some type of identification system in Washington. It's going to be readily available. It's going to preempt the entire country. It'll probably entail fingerprinting of some sort.
Thank you. But we're not going to have it so fast that it's going to be resolved during this legislative session at the federal level, obviously.
No, sir.
Thank you.
Hey, Representative Dwyer.
Let me ask the police officer a question from the state police. You made reference to this here remarkable device that automates fingerprint identification. Are you contemplating, before you ever heard of this bill, did you contemplate the purchase of such a device?
Mr. Chairman, we have, as directed from the last legislative session, we have done a study into automated fingerprint systems, and we do anticipate the probability of acquisition of an automated fingerprint system. So the answer to that is yes.
Okay, another question? So the bottom line, though, in the way that I see it, that this study in here, in the way that it's funded by the from the general fund dollars, conceivably would be a way for you to pay for that in addition to your current budget projections. Is that correct?
Chairman Calhoun, Representative Dreyer, the anticipated cost of an AFIS system did not include these costs associated with fingerprint checks regarding firearm transactions. What it would entail is the acquisition of additional equipment, which would then convert to obviously to additional costs. And that $1 million figure, based on 100 transactions, is the best estimate we can make at this time.
You mean 100,000 transactions?
100,000 transactions. It would be about $1 million.
Thank you, Representative Dwyer. I think the, I don't know where the committee is at on this, but I think the committee is maybe in favor of removing the fingerprinting for all but handguns and concealed weapon permits. I'd be correct in my assumption if I ran that by the committee.
Acting the study.
We're going to be impacting the study. They're going to have to do this. They're going to have to do the study now.
Okay. Ask Major Renfro, with regard to the thumbprint on the rifles, the proposed language says that nothing in this statute is to affect the way rifles are sold. And in that respect, the thumbprint sort of proves identification after the fact, or a record check after the fact, and then that information becomes part of the study. However, if a rifle purchaser is found to be prohibited from possessing or owning, doesn't say purchasing, but possessing or owning a firearm under current ORS 166-250, that state police would be notified. So I'd presume you'd go contact the person if you could. I guess what I'm saying is the for the net widening that we're looking at here in terms of purchasers for rifles and shotguns and so forth, whether or not the thumbprint is worth it in that case versus running background checks based upon other identification and more traditional other optional means.
Chairman Calhoun, Representative Bryan, the reason the fingerprint is so critical is because the Identification Bureau simply cannot make a positive identification without it. It can, based upon a name and a date of birth, run a records check. And of course, that would not be necessarily accurate, nor would we even necessarily enter the exact record this individual may have. The study, however, could continue based upon the other criteria. If the local agencies notified us that they found information of illegal possession of firearms, we could add that to the study. And we anticipate doing that in the event this bill passes. But we prefer to do the identification work based on fingerprints, because that to us is the only positive means for that identification.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, one other question, Major. As you think about shootings, homicides in Oregon, do you know off the top of your head what percentage are with rifles versus handguns?
Chairman Calhoun, Representative Ryan, the greater percentage is with handguns, perhaps as much as 75% in relationship to firearm deaths.
Surprised it's not higher. With hand, I said I'm surprised it's not higher with the handguns than 75%.
Representative Bryan, it probably would be higher, but most of those people are not proficient with handguns. We investigate probably as many attempted homicides or woundings as we do actual homicides. The proficiency with a handgun just isn't there. I'd like to add also that the original 5 days wasn't for a background investigation. It was what's known as a cooling off period. And in my 30-year career, I've covered more suicides that were committed with rifles and shotguns than I have suicides that were committed with handguns.
I don't, Mr. Chair, I wouldn't assume that this bill is after suicidal, is it?
Right.
Let's, council's brought some things to my attention. I think is it fair to represent to council that the committee wants to get this section out of the bill? If that's the case, then we're going to try to work with council to readjust the study so that we don't have to have any fingerprints for long rifles.
I'd like to see what the bill looks like in other provisions if we do that.
Let's do that. I think that we've got support to get that out, but council's going to have to work on it. Appreciate your help with this, and we'll try to work out the other option before we move forward on this.
What do you have to do is here.
Let's see. I know Representative Bryan has to leave to be somewhere at 5 o'clock. I don't want to drag this out because I think some of the members, including myself, might have some plans right now. But you think we might need a evening meeting before our Wednesday meeting? Is that
well? Or we could do, Mr. Chair, represent members of the committee. I'm trying to schedule our next meeting for next Wednesday. We're going to kick out civil and criminal next Wednesday and take their time. I think the question is: are committee members willing to start at 1:30 and go into the evening if necessary? I mean, we're going to need one long session. Do you want it to be next Wednesday if we start next Wednesday afternoon? Or do you want to schedule a evening other than to follow an afternoon schedule? And I'd like to get people to have notice so that they can adjust their calendars accordingly.
Chair, my hunch is that we're going to do better by coming at it a couple hours at a time, going away, coming back, seeing what we've got, coming back, biting off another chunk. Otherwise, I'm afraid we're going to get bogged down and we'll end up spending 9 hours and not getting anywhere. I really think it's like a term paper. We're going to need to work on a draft and come back and see what it looks like, and work on a draft and come back and see what it looks like.
Let's get together and potentially move through our bigger amendments, then we'll try to follow much of what Representative Clark has outlined. We'll try to bite off a bigger chunk on next Wednesday, and then we'll come back and try to fine-tune. Plan? Return.